Before we begin today's story, here's a word from a fellow podcaster.
I'm TK, your guide to the past as we uncover the people, events, and little-known facts hidden in the shadows of your old history textbooks. From Empress Baddies to activist profiles, turkey gods and the history of the toothbrush, tattoos, Pompeii peepees, and everything in between, you can find it all here. There's no telling how far we'll dig or how many historical facts we'll re-examine. No event is too small and no topic is too big because this is for the love of history.
My name is Talia Smith and you're listening to Season 3 of Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast. There are stories all around. We tell stories every day. We consume books and movies, travel the digital landscape, and we talk to people. How could we connect without stories? I think it's impossible. This season, we explore all of what home can mean through sharing stories with a strong sense of place, love, family, or tradition. Join us for Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast, Season 3. This episode was recorded in Maryland and New Jersey and tells the story of one of those states. Enjoy! Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I have an amazing guest, Joy Affleck. Joy is a cutie pie. A multifaceted motion graphics editor that loves film, television, art, and music, and is from all over the East Coast. Welcome to the podcast, Joy.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a longtime fan, and so it's great to be here. When you guys asked me to join, I was so excited. So it's been great to just even write this out, get my ideas out on paper, and just get so excited to talk about something I don't get to talk about that often, you know, film and just generally, you know, film analysis.
Joy and I met at university, and one of the ways we bonded was our mutual love of film. We had a very small film department, and I was a minor, but were you a minor or did you end up majoring in it?
I actually didn't end up doing anything in film. I just took a lot of film analysis classes, and what I ended up doing was I had a media and communications major, and then I had a studio art minor. So I mostly focused on, instead of analysis, I focused it on making my own kind of production-ish major by myself.
Yeah, because when I was there, they didn't have the mass communications program that started for your year.
Yeah, that was like my sophomore year was that major was introduced.
So let's talk about this movie, this story we're going to be sharing today, which is what story are we talking about?
We are talking about The Garden State from 2004.
Ooh, how old were you? How old were you in 2004?
I am bad at math, so I was born in 98, so you do the math.
You are 6 years old.
I was 6 years old. I did not find this movie until I was in high school, but I let me tell you, this movie was made for me. Zach Braff knew I was about to have an existential crisis later down the road.
He definitely did. He was like, Joy is going to be in high school and need this movie and then move to New Jersey.
Exactly.
So before we get into it, can you please provide us with three fun facts about the story we will be sharing today?
All right, so some fun facts. These are some of my favorite fun facts about it. So first of all, obviously it's called The Garden State, so it's revolving around New Jersey. So the film is almost entirely shot in New Jersey because Zach Braff is originally from New Jersey. So his hope was to romanticize his home state and his hometown of South Orange by filming in like Newark, Maplewood, and Cranford, and just surrounding areas to kind of, I guess, redress this this bad stereotype that New Jersey has. The second fun fact I would like to say is just because, oh God, the soundtrack, y'all. If I can tell you something, just listen to the soundtrack. Zach Braff was awarded a Grammy Award for Best Compilation Soundtrack Album for Motion Pictures, Television, or Other Media in 2005 for this soundtrack. It was entirely, you know, compiled by him, and it's so beautiful. People have said that these songs aren't typically, they don't typically go together, but when they're compiled together, it feels like they've always belonged together.
Yeah.
And lastly, I feel like I have to address this. Contemporary opinions on this film are relatively divided. I think as a movie and as a culture, we've grown more aware of the manic pixie dream girl trope, and we've grown more critical of, you know, these protagonists being self-loathing, cishet, white male leads. And so I think regardless of the division, though, the film still beautifully represents one's longing for home, and that's, and that theme still translates regardless of, you know, who the protagonist is, how they come to this realization.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get into that, because while you found this film and fell in love with it from a relatively young age, I watched it for the first time last night. So yes, we're definitely coming from very different perspectives in that case. But also, you know, we talk about New Jersey a lot on this podcast, and we talk a lot about home. That's our theme for this season. But neither of us grew up in New Jersey, which we'll talk about, but both of us found New Jersey. And yes, we both spent a significant amount of our life here. So it's going to be fun to kind of talk about how we can relate to the Garden State. So let's introduce this story. What is The Garden State? What's it about?
I'm going to give you a general rundown of the film. So The Garden State is written, directed, and starred by Zach Braff, and it was released on July 28th, 2004. So the film revolves around, after years away, the unsuccessful part-time actor Andrew Largeman, played by Zach Braff. He returns to his home state of New Jersey to attend his mother's funeral. So immediately he's confronted with what he's been avoiding: his unfriendly past, his over-controlling father, who's played by Ian Holm. And so in a chance meeting while being back in his hometown, Largeman meets a girl named Sam, played by Natalie Portman. She's very quirky, and they have this immediate deep connection. And together with her and a gang of his old high school friends, including Peter Skarsgård, he heals these old traumas from the past and forges stronger relationships with new friends, old friends, you know, and just comes to terms with the past, lives in the present, and learns to live in the present.
Yeah. So why are we talking about this story now? As we said, came out in 2004, something, you know, it's been said that it might have been dated at this point. Why now? Why this story?
So I really think, regardless of how our awareness or like the view of the film has changed, you know, oh, this straight white man having these regular problems, needing an independent woman to change his life, you know, that whole thing. I think regardless of that, the overall theme remains this whole idea of the loss of home, the concept of our childhood home disappearing and not being perfect. The film is representative for those who, you know, home wasn't a fond memory, but maybe it was a motivation to be in a different place. And I think for everyone, there's this reconciliation of from where you come from and where you are now or where you have been. And I think that's timeless, and regardless of who the protagonist is, because that will always exist. You know, the bird will always have to leave the nest, and you'll always have to make that transition. We all transition to an adulthood. And I think this will always be a part of our life. That transitional period is going to exist.
Yeah.
So I think it's timeless in a sense.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into it. And before we do, before we say once upon a time, I want to make a disclaimer. This episode is going to be a little bit different, because one of the amazing things about storytelling is that there are so many forms and ways in which to tell a story. And film is very special, because in film, you can tell a story using many different techniques. When watching a good movie, in my opinion, you should be able to both listen without watching and watch without listening to understand the film's main thesis. So in the telling of this story, in our telling of The Garden State, we're going to look at the way the story is told. It is how Zach Braff and the creative team crafted this film that made it so relevant to our theme and to life. So before we get into Once Upon a Time and we say the magical words, let's talk about the characters that we're going to be discussing today, because I think it's important that we have a stronghold on who everyone is and why they're important and why they're in the story. And I think we should start off with our lead, our principal, our straight man here.
We have Andrew Largeman.
Andrew Largeman, Zach Braff's character. So who is Andrew Largeman?
So Andrew Largeman, he's our protagonist, as we said, and he's kind of a detached, I believe he's 20, about like 24 to 26. He's in his, you know, early to mid 20s, and he had left New Jersey. He had gone to boarding school for a while, boarding high school, and he had been away from home for about 9 years. So very distant. When the movie picks up, he's living in California as a part-time actor, but kind of failed because he's also working as, you know, a part-time waiter as well. Yeah. But you can kind of see that he's not doing that hot in California, but he's just a detached, you know, he just doesn't, he doesn't have much sense of self yet. He doesn't have much purpose.
We also meet a lot of friends and family throughout, but I guess we'll just go naturally to his parents, because his parents play a huge role in the story, even though his mom is not alive through any of it. But who are his parents?
So his father is the one that's, you see, I guess, his primary parental figure throughout the film. And they have a very detached relationship. His father is a psychiatrist and has kind of acted weirdly, because it's not supposed to happen. He had been diagnosing his own son, which is not okay. It's not allowed technically. So it's like a weird, weird family boundary there. Pretty much their relationship divided when, in the past, you find this out in the movie, that Zach Braff's character on accident had paralyzed his mother from the waist down. And so from that incident, she had drowned in the bathtub. Years later.
When he
from
was a
the
child, he accidentally paralyzed his mother. And then like 20 years later.
For this funeral. Yeah. She had drowned because, and so they had thought that, oh, he was angry. You know, they didn't know what to do with it. So they sent him away to boarding school. And so there had been this whole disconnect in their relationship between the father and son, where they hadn't talked pretty much since that point. They haven't had a real conversation since that point. And the mother, I think, is the one that he understood familial love from, from the dialogue. That's his sense of home and love came from little aspects of his mom that you pick up throughout the film. Yeah. And it's him picking up the pieces and trying to understand what home is with his father and avoiding that for a lot of the movie too.
Yeah. And other aspects of home, as a lot of people know, is the friend, your chosen family. And we meet a couple of his friends throughout the story, but there's one friend that is kind of what I would consider one of the primary characters, and that's the character of Mark, played by Peter Sarsgaard. Can you tell us a little bit about Mark?
I love Mark so much. Mark is so funny. And here's the thing about Mark is I think he contextualizes perfectly when you go home. If you are someone that has left a town that maybe has nothing for you and you know you've outgrown it a little bit, he represents that high school deadbeat that stayed in high school. He's this stoner boy that lives with his mom, doesn't really have a job, sells like, what was it? Not magic cards. He sells like trading cards.
He collects Desert Storm trading cards. Which is niche.
And it's so niche. His actual job, though, his main job is being a gravedigger. And I think what contextualizes him beautifully in the beginning of the film is you see him in the background of the funeral, of Andrew Largeman's mother's funeral in the beginning of the movie. And you see him in the distance. Andrew Largeman notices him and goes over to him. And he's currently grave robbing someone before he's burying them. He's stealing the jewelry off of them. Yeah. And you can kind of see, like, this guy maybe doesn't have the best morals, but over the movie, you tell that he's such a genuine person. He really does care. He's trying to be a good friend. He's just a guy trying to get his life together, which I appreciate. I think it contextualizes perfectly his home, the hometown that Andrew comes from, the kind of people that he grew up with.
And then we meet somebody who Zach Braff's character, I should just say Andrew Largeman, not Zach Braff's character, whatever. meets that he didn't grow up with, that wasn't part of his original concept of home, and that is Natalie Portman's Sam. So who is Sam?
So Sam is, as we all like to say, a manic pixie dream girl. She's pretty quirky. Let's be real here. I love Sam. She's quirky. She's weird. She's a compulsive liar. She has all these little weird tics about her, right? But she's a very genuine person. They meet at a doctor's office. Andrew Largeman scheduled a doctor's appointment when he was home at the recommendation of his father. And he meets Natalie Portman, or Sam, in the waiting room. And she's, you know, lied about why she's there, but she's pretty much there because she has severe epilepsy. They kind of meet in these very odd circumstances, but she's initially very warm to him. They listen to music together. And she, even though is a new person in his life, she's a familiar person. She's from that town. She's from that same environment. And she shows him, I think, a new way to see the world. She shows him a new way to see the same place that he's known forever.
She also introduces him right away to family.
And oh, I think
one of the benefits of her character is her concept of family and her version of familial love that she received that was different than his. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. But I think that's an important way to set up her character.
Oh, 100%.
Let's introduce some of the words that we're going to be using today, because we want to make sure everyone is on the same track. And so there's a word we're going to be using today called mise-en-scène. Can you explain what mise-en-scène is?
Of course. So mise-en-scène originally comes from theater, and it's a theater term that has kind of migrated its way to film because it's still completely relevant. So mise-en-scène for both kind of refers to the stage design, arrangement of actors in a scene for theater or film. So that could be, you know, clothes design, set design, to even the blocking of actors spatially.
And then we're also going to be talking about the cinematography, which includes lighting, the cameras, the type of the shots that the camera takes. We're going to talk about editing, the colors, the length of cuts. We're going to talk a lot about editing, and we're going to talk about sound. So with all of that context and with all of that introduction, because that's quite an introduction to this story, let's begin with Once Upon a Time.
Once Upon a Time.
Zach Braff was in a movie called Garden State. But how does this movie begin? What struck me as a first-time viewer was the opening of this film. It's mm-hmm. quite overwhelming. Can you describe what we see in the very beginning of this movie?
So in the beginning, and I would really equate it to like a montage, like an artistic montage scene almost. So it doesn't really have any direct effect on the plot. It starts with Zach Braff. It's a slow shot zooming out from a close-up of Zach Braff's face. And you see that he's on an airplane as it seems to be crashing. And everyone around him in slow-mo is freaking out. You know, everyone's being tossed aside and he's sitting there and completely indifferent.
You get the disarming audio. You get a chaotic mise-en-scène, I should say.
Yes, exactly.
And then you get to see Zach Braff. It almost seems as if he's dissociating.
Oh, completely.
You don't really know what's going on. It's a bizarre introduction to what this movie is going to be.
It's completely bizarre, and I think it will completely make sense by the time we get to the end of this episode. It's a very blurred shot. It kind of feels like a fever dream of a mm-hmm. scene. And there's so many reasons why, as I think, as we said, he's medicated. He's on like lithium, you know, something very, very heavy medication. He's on a number of heavy medications. And he's just, I don't think he really knows where he is in his own body at this point mm-hmm. and where he is in his life. And I think that's kind of the state that he's in. If a plane was crashing, he wouldn't care, kind of. That's how the movie starts. That's his emotional state.
It's just numb.
Just numb. I don't know where I am because he's in transit. He's on a flight. Like, he's not in any destination point, right? Like, he's in transit.
So what's really interesting, speaking of transit, is this opening montage's use of transitions. I love a good transition. I'm not good at them, but I love it when they're out there. They're really interesting because it helps kind of disorient the reality. When we transition out of the airplane horror scene when Andrew turns the air conditioning.
Yeah.
He touches a phone, not a cell phone because it's 2004, like a
Or, you know, phone. Like a landline phone. A
landline phone. And then that is the transition to his bedroom.
To his bedroom. And it's so
it was a dream.
And it's so stark, right? And it's crazy because he's still so removed. He looks completely not fazed by the dream he had just had, you know? And he's just completely, it's this beautiful above shot of him lying in his bed, just completely in the center, everything so symmetrical, just stark, just cold.
Mm-hmm. And that lighting that we see, that cold color lighting, we'll talk about the lighting and everything as we go on. It's something that's carried through with his character, not the entire movie, but for a vast majority of it.
If you're thinking about, you know, color and lighting and stuff like that in this context, if we really want to think about that, the difference between, and we'll talk about this later, the difference between the coloring, the lighting, and the type of shots, the way that they're composed in the beginning with this, you know, stark bed scene. He's in the middle, white. Grays, just hard lines, very rigid looking. To by the end of the movie, we have these crazy juxtaposition where it's so much looser, so much more vibrant. You can see this transformation of character that comes with it.
Absolutely, it's really quite striking at first to see. The montage continues when we hear a voicemail of his father telling him his mother died, and then it transitions into his place of work, which then transitions to him going home. And it is in that scene, that opening montage, that we're able to really grasp who his character is. And we don't hear from him barely at all, but it's through the film that we're able to get a grasp of, oh, this guy is going through some crap.
He does not like where he is.
And he is not able to communicate his feelings whatsoever.
Yeah, he's muted. His whole world is muted. His palate's muted. His life is muted. His personality's muted.
The movie goes on. He gets to the funeral. He sees his friend at the funeral. But what's more striking cinematically is when we get to his home. Can you tell us? What happens once we get into the home?
So one thing I think before we even talk about what happens in the home is the home, you can tell it, he comes from this upper echelon, or like, you know, the upper middle class of New Jersey suburbs. So it's a big house. His dad is like a psychologist, psychiatrist. So you can tell that he has their nice appliances, ample space. They live a comfortable life, you can tell. But it's very clear cut. It's very cold. There's not much furniture in the house.
There's no knickknacks. None.
There's no knickknacks. Like, knickknacks is the perfect word. Like, you don't see books on a bookshelf, really. You don't see, like, little family photos anywhere like you would associate with a home. It kind of looks like one of those rental, you know, when you're seeing a property and it's completely, and it's just like, this is furniture. That's a chair. Like, that's what that house looks like. And so You're kind of, that's your first impression, right? And he's sitting on a couch. You know how you have that reception, that memorial post a funeral. And so he's sitting on the couch with his Aunt Sylvia. And his Aunt Sylvia says, well, you haven't been here in like 9 years, you know? And I love that because I think that's the perfect encapsulation of when you come home after a long time and you see your family and they're kind of giving, you know, hustling you a little bit about it. Oh, you haven't been here in a long time. He's like, yeah. And she goes, oh, well, your mother redid the hallway bathroom. She had a beautiful wallpaper. I made you a shirt from the extra fabric. You want to try it on before you leave for another 9 years? Which I love. Uh-huh. Family just digging at each other, which you can tell it's uncomfortable. Like they're already jabbing at him for being gone, and he's not even saying anything. Just cuts to him going to the hallway bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. Another straight on shot. Kind of a medium shot, you know, you see the whole from his shoulders up of him, if you were the mirror, I guess.
Yes.
And you see Zach Braff just standing there, and his shirt is the exact same pattern as the wall. Like, he is camouflaged into this wall. You see his arms starkly like popping out from the pattern, and you just see his blue eyes just There's no words. He's just staring, like peering up from this wall. And it's this beautiful, I think, comparison. And it's the start of this introduction in the movie between the relationship of people come from their houses. You know, like Andrew Largeman is such a product of his environment. He's such a product of this rigid, distant home life. Comes from that material. The fabric from the wall is the fabric of his being, right? But at the same time, something that's so familiar, like a hallway bathroom that's supposed to be at your own house. I think you mentioned this when we were talking earlier. It's also very uncomfortable. It's not familiar.
Yeah. It's when you go away to college and you come back and suddenly there's a Chick-fil-A or suddenly, you know, the Super Walmart. And you're like, this isn't what's supposed to be here, but also this is home.
Yeah, your parents like make a new guest bedroom and you're like, wait, that was my brother's room. Oh, like that's different, but it's the same, but different.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very specific feeling, right? Like it's something that is hard to describe.
You know, there's something technically wrong, but also, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think that as we're going back to like mise-en-scène, right? The term that we've discussed about clothing, set design, and the blocking of actors, that this first shot, right, of this first introduction of one household, does mise-en-scène so well by showing us, oh, this is not really furnished house. It doesn't really make you feel like there's any attachment to the home. Oh, by having these having these colder colors, you can feel this lack of caring. You can feel this like clinical approach to father-son relationship. You can feel all of this trepidation with, I don't know how to approach you. I don't know how to talk to you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I think, through the mise-en-scène showing you the indescribable qualities of home. You know, what is a home? How do we articulate that into words? I think it's the atmosphere, the warmth of a house or the lack of warmth. And just, again, really driving home that the environment shapes who we are as individuals. And you see that so hard through this movie with the other characters that we meet.
Yeah. So let's move forward in time in the film. After the repass of the funeral, Andrew Largeman ends up going to a party at his friend's house. There's a whole party scene, but after, the next morning, when he wakes up at the party at his friend's house with words written all over his body, crazy, crazy night, we are suddenly thrust into a very new and different environment that is the complete opposite, in most respects, to his own environment. For me, it was striking that we are greeted at a table with four characters. Two of them mean nothing to the plot, but but a lot to Andrew's view of the world that we're going to see. So can you kind of describe the mise-en-scène of his friend Mark's house that we are thrust into after waking up from a wild night of partying?
So as I said, Mark is kind of the exact, I think, encapsulation of that kid that stayed in your hometown forever. They both, him and his mom smoke weed together. You can tell that it's dingy. There are cats everywhere for no reason. There are always cats everywhere. And you have this very interesting dialogue over the kitchen table, but I think that's the closest you ever see characters for the first time. It's like sitting together. And it's an odd conversation, right? Because his friend's Mark's mother is dating someone from their high school class. So that's weird, you know, obviously weird. But it's the most normal conversation around that table that we've seen so far. The mother's talking about her boyfriend and he works at Medieval Times. And she's like, oh, he was just knighted, you know, like, you know, and it's like a normal conversation, even though it's the most not normal situation.
Yeah, well, first of all, just a personal note, what I thought was funny was we've got, what's his face, who plays Sheldon Cooper.
Oh my gosh. It starts with a J. Jim Parsons.
We have Jim Parsons, who plays the mother's young boyfriend
who works as a knight at Medieval Times.
At the Lyndhurst Medieval Times, which I have spent time at.
And of course you have. Hell yeah, that's the most you thing you would have
been funny. That's where my parents' rehearsal dinner was when they got married, was at the Lyndhurst Medieval Times.
Talia, you shut up right now. That is the most you, of course.
That connected me to home, personally.
I think it's so funny, too, because, you know, this is something I didn't know about New Jersey before coming here. And it wasn't until I was rewatching, when prepping for this podcast, actually, I watched this with one of my new roommates who's from New Jersey. He's lived here his whole life. And he paused it at that. And he goes, I love medieval times. And I was like, wait, there's medieval times here? And he goes, yeah, Joy, it's Lyndhurst medieval. And I was like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, you could go see a joust. You could go do all that. And I was like, oh, Zach Braff is using very specific, you know, and throughout the movie, you see this whole thing where he mentions like Rutgers, Newark. He'll bring in all of these New Jersey specific locations and events, yeah. Which I think is beautiful.
Yeah, me too. I really love that connection. And we're in this space where we have this guy dressed up in full, got Jim Parsons full. Specifically. Full.
Jim Parsons specifically.
Full night garb. We have the mother.
Smoking a cig, I'm pretty sure.
She's kind of looking a little, not her best.
I'm telling you, she looks like one of these moms, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep, yeah, perfect. We've got a house in utter disarray from the party, but also you can tell that the house generally looks like it is in disarray.
It's not well kept up. The mom's talking about pyramid schemes, you know?
Yeah. But then we get a scene where they're all sitting on the couch and you see the mom about to leave for an appointment and you see her go and give her son a kiss and you see a great shot of Andrew's face just kind of watching and not saying anything because he doesn't say anything, but you can see in the way that the shot is crafted, how that kiss is crafted and his response is crafted, that this is something that he might not have ever gotten and something that he longs for. And I think that was a really beautiful moment.
And I think it will connect to a quote later on that will really, really linger on. That's from another character that just points out, she says it much later in the movie, but you can see Andrew Largeman throughout the whole movie, as you said, these moments where he's not saying anything, but really taking it in where he's in it.
Yeah.
It relates back to that quote where you're definitely in it right now.
Let's talk a little bit about that character who will say some really great lines later in the film. When Andrew Largeman goes to the doctor for some headaches he's been having, he's in the waiting room, as we mentioned before, and we meet Sam. And the waiting room, you know, itself is like a typical doctor's office waiting room, and we're not going to get into too much of the mise-en-scene of that scene, but it is important to note because that is where we meet Sam, and Sam is important.
Yes.
And we're very quickly introduced to Sam's home.
Yes. And it's almost at an odd pace. The movie takes place over the course of 4 days.
Yeah.
Only 4 days. So they have this immediate, intense, like intimate connection where they kind of understand each other. And I think it's funny because you have a very stark scene, like a waiting room, but then a woman comes in that has a seeing eye dog that starts, you know, smelling Andrew Largeman's crotch and he does, or like, trying to hump his leg, I think.
Yeah,
you have Sam that's just laughing at the side. They don't know each other, just a stranger, but she's laughing at him, just enjoying the moment, and they're riffing off each other, making this small talk, and then eventually, you know, the blind woman leaves and takes her dog, but they end up starting a conversation, and you get to know that she's quirky, she's definitely,
she's not like other girls, some might say,
as we will talk about in her environment, the house that she comes up with, they just care about being them.
Let's talk about that house. Let's talk about who we meet when we get to the house. And that's the general state, the mise-en-scene, as we say, what we feel in that home.
Yes. So first and foremost, Sam's family reminds me of, there's always that one family in your childhood that was like this in your town, right? That had like 5 dogs, 20 hamsters, tubes everywhere, you know, maybe the carpet smells like pee and it's chaotic, but somehow they're still paying the bills and have it all together, but there's a lot of love kind of thing going on. That is exactly their kind of house. So when she introduces him very quickly to her family, right after the doctor's office, which is odd, obviously, but her mother greets him with such love, you know, there's just so much mom energy, genuine mom energy. And then, you know, you're introduced to her adopted brother, Tetembe, who was adopted later in life, who goes to Rutgers for criminal justice. And so they're trying to support him. Also, if you just are considering the mise-en-scene, right, if we're moving past the characters and we're going back to mise-en-scene, the house, you know, orange walls, orange carpet, old TV. We're talking like
old TV.
We're talking old TV.
Like old for 2004 TV.
Yeah, like old. Like it's sitting on the floor. We got some knobs on there. And then also outside of the, you know, we already have this association that it's a quirky household because they have their own pet cemetery outside in their own yard because they had so many animals, you know. Yeah. So like this is a very individual house, but there's so much love.
And you start to see the color scheme of the movie start to switch from very cold, like stainless steel, I almost want to describe it, to a warmer color palette, the oranges, the browns, the what I like to call 90s coffee shop chic.
Oh my gosh, that is the perfect way to describe it. That is the perfect way to describe her house. Like, oh my gosh, this coffee shop. And we'll talk more about, because color can translate past like mise-en-scene into editing. So I want to leave some of that color to talk about in editing. But like, if we're just talking about just starkly in mise-en-scene with the clothes and the set design and the furniture that's included, that's already present. You see from Andrew's house with all these greens, blues, whites to Sam's house has no white walls. It's all colors. It's
and covered. And
it's covered. Stuff. There's how did you call them? Knickknacks. There's knickknacks everywhere. Full of knickknacks. Tchotchkes everywhere.
And there's another moment within that house that I think is really important to the development of this story. And is important to the mise-en-scene of this story. And it's the alligator ice skating scene. Can you explain that scene and that's importance and kind of how it's shot?
So as I think we mentioned about Sam's epilepsy, though she does have severe epilepsy that had started later in life. But before that, before she had epilepsy, she used to be an amazing figure skater, apparently, and used to compete in figure skating. And so her mother, I think it's supposed to be that typical thing when you invite your significant other or anyone you're interested in over, and then your mom brings out all that embarrassing crap that you don't want her to bring out. And she goes, oh, have you seen this video of Sam ice skating? And Sam's like, oh my God, you know. But it shows, number one, the mom loves her daughter so much that she's like, let me dig out this video of my daughter ice skating as an alligator. You can't even see Sam. I think that's a huge point. You can't even like tell that it's Sam because it's a fully head-to-toe alligator costume. You could just see an alligator figure skating. But the mom doesn't even care. She just knows her daughter's in there. Yeah. And it's like, that's my daughter. Everyone gathers around this to just celebrate this moment that has passed. And in that shot, right, I think the mise-en-scene is so important because you have this one shot that's kind of like the camera is almost like the television. You're looking at the family sitting on the couch. But Andrew Largemans, no, he's sitting between Tembe and the mother on the couch. And they're all, as you're seeing the progression of households, right, from Mark, you see them sitting at the round table with the knight. You get closer. And then at this, all their knees are kind of touching. They're so close together. And it's a very unified moment between them. That's the closest you ever see them. And it's a beautiful thing when you're considering that progression of he's warming up to people. But then also, if you look at that scene via color and costume, Sam's family is wearing these warm tone colors that kind of, I think, again, as we mentioned in the hallway bathroom scene, it's bringing this idea of you kind of are where you come from. This warm environment has made Sam such a warm person. It has made Tembe such a warm and caring person as well. And that has only furthered, you know, how they view the world, has shaped how they view the world and how they relate with each other. And that's something that Andrew Largemans never had.
I think one of my favorite moments of that scene is when Andrew and Sam are standing up to leave to go on their next adventure or whatever. And Sam's mom gives her a hug. And then Sam's mom gives Andrew a hug.
And he lingers.
And he lingers. And nothing is said, but you just see his face. And it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking because you see him relax into the hug. Like, he's never had a hug for, like, that long. Like, he hasn't had the contact in so long. He hasn't felt safe in so long, And so you have that beautiful moment. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned it.
That was one of the moments that stuck out to me the most, I think, throughout the entire film. And I think one of the reasons why it did is because right now in the world that we're living in, and while the vaccine is up and up and up, and hopefully, you know, any day now, we'll be able to hug each other. But it's something I think we're all kind of missing. It's to kind of, you know, keep going with, see another home. I mean, what's really interesting about this movie is it's a sense of adventure. Sam and Andrew and Mark team up and they go on an adventure to get Andrew a going away present. We wind up at another home. And this home is the most unconventional home in the film, but also my dream home. Not really, actually, not at all. But we end up in a quarry in Newark. And I want to talk about the mise-en-scène of that scene and the transition from being in a quarry to inside of the home in the quarry. So can you kind of describe those moments for us?
It is pouring rain. And so by at this point, Andrew Largeman is like, you have dragged us around, Mark, all around New Jersey to the creepiest places of Newark. I have no idea where we are. You have brought Sam through all of this. She's so innocent. Like, what are you doing? And he goes, it's going to be worth it. It's going to be worth it. Promise me. And so they all head down this giant quarry, which is apparently supposed to be a mall. That was a funny moment. Yeah, it was supposed to be a mall, which I think is funny now in my last time viewing it, knowing how many malls are in New Jersey and how how often they're trying to construct malls, and me being like, oh, of course they were trying to build a mall. But it's like, but there's a natural phenomenon that happened under it where it was like a natural, like, giant quarry. And so there's this man, I forget exactly his point for being down there. I think it's to preserve the quarry, right?
It was to protect the quarry, to make sure nobody's, like, doing anything dumb in the quarry.
Dumb in the quarry. And it's this man that pretty much lives in a houseboat.
Uh-huh.
But grounded at the bottom of a quarry in a boat with his wife and baby.
Yeah. We meet him when they knock on the door. And that's their first moment, is seeing a man with a baby in the pouring rain on a houseboat in a Newark quarry.
And number one, I would just like to say, I thought there were quarries everywhere when I came to New Jersey just because of this movie. I thought I would just... But number two, I think we're getting more absurd. Like, this movie is absurd. You've now reached your most absurd. We're standing in a houseboat at the bottom of a quarry with a man and his family, and you're like, why do you live like this, sir? And he's pretty much saying, the only thing that's really keeping him going, and it's just like, maybe it's my ego, you know, but it's also just all he needs is the love of his family. He has his wife, his baby, and he has his purpose in life, which is like protecting the quarry. And also you see a lot of love. You have these, again, little actions I think that Andrew Largeman hadn't had in his own life. Like, it starts pouring rain, right? And even the wife, before they leave, says, hey, do you want some trash bags? You know, that small consideration of, let me take care of you.
And they mention that, you know, this is their Noah's Ark. You know, they're on a boat, they have their family, and they have a purpose for being on that boat. And the aesthetic in that particular house bears resemblance to both Mark's house and Sam's house.
Yes.
It's chaos, but it's warm chaos.
It's warm chaos, and it's also the tiniest house you've seen. Mm-hmm. You've seen a large range of houses. You've seen from mansions to a literal tiny houseboat at the bottom of a quarry. And it's funny because I think you're disassociating happiness comes from mansions. Happiness comes from this. Happiness can come from literally I could live in a houseboat at the bottom of a rock quarry, right, and be completely content.
And it's at that point, I think, that we see Andrew just become overwhelmed. And you see color come into his cheeks, which we don't really see. And I think that's really beautiful. And the makeup of the film is, you know, Andrew goes from being very gaunt and very, very pale and very white.
Yeah, he looks sick at the beginning. Sickly.
And by the end, he's in a warm home. There's color back on his cheeks. And you can even see in his physical being how witnessing love changed his physical appearance, which was really interesting to me.
And at that point, Simon and Garfunkel's Only Living Boy in New York comes in, and you realize that he's a living boy. And also, to contextualize the outside of this houseboat too, it's not well kept. Like, there's construction cranes everywhere, and like just random drilling equipment, and they all stand on one of those cranes, and he just screams into the abyss, and he screams at and that's the first you see release of emotion from him, just pure release of emotion. And you know you finally get the sense from the guy in the houseboat. Andrew Largeman says, good luck with the infinite abyss, and the man says, good luck with yours as well.
And that's also the scene where he finally kisses Sam. Which was a very important moment for him.
I just don't know why the third person was there. I feel like I relate most to Peter Skarsgård when he's just like, literally, it's like in slow-mo and he just goes, looks so
yeah. He like backs out of the shot.
He just backs out of the shot and like turns the other way.
What a relatable feeling. By the end, so that we're not leaving this off on a cliffhanger, we Andrew Largeman, because this was, you know, he has to go home in 4 days. He makes a decision to not go home and to stay with Sam.
Well, originally, first of all, so they're sitting at Newark Airport, which I love because I've been there so many times.
I've sat at Newark Airport too many times.
And they're having this intense conversation. She's sobbing, you know, and he's like, this is not over. I'm just putting an ellipsis on it. I have a lot of stuff to figure out on my own. Also, in these 4 days, it's the first time he's been unmedicated in his whole life, right? Like, so he's off these hard medications. And so this is the first time he's kind of getting a sense of who he is without that too. So he's saying, I have a lot of stuff I need to work on. So we're going to put an ellipsis on it. I'm going to go to LA, work on my stuff and come back. And she's, you know, sobbing. And then you have him go away.
We see him in the airplane.
Oh yeah, you see him in the airplane. Yeah, you do see him in the airplane just sitting there kind of like in the first shot.
Yeah, we see a brief moment. He's not numb. And I think that's the big difference.
Yes, he's not numb. And also you have this, it's not that dreamlike state, right? Like that they had edited in where it's like this foggy, unfocused. He's very grounded in reality in that moment. I think you can fully sense that he's present for the first time in his life. Like he's finally understood to let go of the past or, you know, acknowledge the past and just stay in the present. He runs off the plane, right? Cuts to Natalie Portman crying in the phone booth and he opens it and she's like, what are you doing here? And he's like, that was stupid. You know, the ellipsis is dumb. I have a lot of stuff to work on, but right now I am happy with you. And right now is all that matter. I have my own autonomy now. I have my own drive. I have an infinite abyss, but I have someone to explore it with.
Yeah. I personally have critiques of that ending, but I think for the context of this film, that would have been too big of him to not have found his mother and his girlfriend. That wasn't a realistic.
And I think when I watched it, you know, Sunny, I watched it with my roommate that is a guy, and I was saying, you know, that was a critique for me upon watching it as an adult woman, is being like, wow, I'm not no one's mom. Like, right. No, work on your own stuff. Work like, actually,
come back to me when you're
and
when
come
you're
back better. To me when you good.
I only known him for 4 days. Let him work his own stuff out.
For real.
Ladies.
You don't have to fix your man, so you're not anyone's mom.
You're not anyone's mom. So, what's really cool about this is we're kind of coming at this from very different angles, but you work with media. You're an editor.
I work for video editing and social media. I think one of my favorite things when we're talking about editing is that good editing is not noticeable. Mm-hmm. Like to a casual viewer, they shouldn't be able to notice color grading. They shouldn't be able to notice these specific techniques because it's supposed to feel seamless. And it just takes this trained eye to really see the intention behind it. Every transition has intention. Every color has intention. And every shot has intention. As an editor, you get to understand that because you're assembling it all together or you're putting that final touches on it. So really when I talk about editing in the Garden State, I mostly want to talk about color grading.
What is color grading before we get into it?
So editing it's a multi-step process. There are different types of editors too. There are colorists, there might be people that assemble it, there are sound editors. But color grading refers to specifically once everything's assembled and everything's kind of compiled together, this is the editor that goes in, the colorist, and will change the highlights and the shadows tones, let's say, of the original shot. And let's say like it's in the desert, right? You might take the highlights and make them more yellow to give you that warm tone. Or let's say it's like a sterile hospital room that's like kind of scary. You might take that highlight and make it green to give you that weird like, oh, something's wrong. You have a lot of emotional correlation to what colors you're using as well. Color grading, I think, is so cool because it's really that small consideration. Again, you wouldn't see it unless you know about it.
but it can change the entire feel of a scene. And so, for instance, in The Garden State, we start this movie in California, right? When he's in LA. If you think about California right now, like close your eyes, boom, California, you are thinking warm, palm trees, sun, like oranges, yellows. But in The Garden State, you don't get any of that. Right. You get these, the whites are very pure white. Like it's a very like hospital white, the walls. Even when he's driving in that traffic scene, kind of gray. It's a kind of gray scene. And so you're not, even when you see palm trees, you're not getting that typical association of Californian colors. You're getting this, I am living in LA and I am a depressed person. And I don't relate to this. You're getting this whole, there is not anything for me here. And you're getting that a lot from the color grading, you know, and it's a lot of these parts of the film working in conjunction to make a point, but the color grading is really putting the nail in the coffin, you know? And something I think when we're going back to Zach Braff's desire to romanticize New Jersey, you have these typical shots of the suburbs of Jersey, you know, like Cranford or something, but vibrant greens, lush lawns. Like these lawns look so green. And then the skies look so blue. And you have these warm, saturated colors. You have, you know, Sam's house, as we mentioned, very warm. You have the scene where they're all jumping into a pool, very crisp, saturated blue, and you have all these colors being introduced to his life. And I think if we're thinking about color grading and we're trying to look at it in The Garden State, let's look at it in the whole, right? Like let's not look at it in scenes like we have been analyzing the movie. From the beginning being in California to the end of the movie being in New Jersey, you see gradually throughout the entire course of this film, it gets more saturated, the colors get brighter, everything gets more vibrant. I think that it represents a number of things. That color, that shift of color represents his journey reconnecting with himself, right? Like he's finally understanding himself. He, after a long time of 9 years of being in this weird transitive state, he's finally living in the present, right?
Yeah.
Secondly, I think this is representing for any person that has had mental health struggles and has been on medication that hasn't worked for them or has been in like a depressive state. It's really representing his improvement of mental health or his journey off of the extreme medication that he was on, like lithium, to being unmedicated, which obviously I'm not recommending anyone just like quit their meds, you know, but I think
it's
that
an important part of the film.
But it is an important part of the film where those meds weren't meant for him anyway, you know, and he, and so you see that transition of he's starting to take his own matters into his own hands, and he can see like it is working for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And that's something that I noticed most of all going through the movie was the shift in color. Another thing I noticed about in the construction of the film was the use of sound. And I'll be honest, like this movie is really touted for its soundtrack. But I knew zero of the songs. I didn't really recognize
them. Okay, I will tell you this. Anyone that has been, all right, how do I phrase this? Anyone that's been depressed or an indie kid in high school, like if you were like an indie kid that's like a hipster in high school or like whatever, you know the Shins. We all know New Slang. A lot of those are your standard entry songs like Iron and Wine, Such Great Heights, Only Living Boy in New York by Simon and Garfunkel. A lot of these are kind of these nostalgic classic, they're kind of timeless.
For my music taste, if you know me, it's absolutely bonkers. However,
Il Volo.
I listen to a lot of things that are I listen to a lot of different music, but what catches me whenever I listen or watch a movie is how the soundscape is and how silence is dealt with. I think sound is one of my favorite elements of film, which makes sense because I make a podcast. So what stuck out to me was how this film used the silence and how they lived in silences for a majority of the film. And, you know, Zach Braff's character didn't have a lot of dialogue, but you knew what he was thinking because of how the silence was crafted around him as a character and how there was never really any pure silence. Meaning the silence that we got in the film, we got a lot of diegetic sound. Diegetic sound just means sound that exists in the world of the film, not soundtrack. So we could hear maybe like the radiator running or, you know, people talking in the background, but it's still silent for focusing on the depths that go beyond words. And I think that really haunts a lot of the earlier scenes where, but slowly, as he finds these meanings, the silences cease to be uncomfortable. And instead of basking in the dread of the silence, we're actually seeing those silences be appreciated, and we're seeing relationships grow in the silence, not being further apart. And I think that was a really beautiful moment of the film, and I really appreciated that. Nothing better than good silence. I've had a lot of fun talking about how this film evokes aspects of home and what is family and what is a mom and what is a friend. But how does this film directly relate to your life? And why does this feel like home to you specifically?
Oh, golly, Talia. I've been waiting to tell this story for years. So first and foremost, I relate a lot to Andrew. I felt very uncomfortable in my own home. I'm from a very small town in rural Maine, and I'm an Asian American woman. So I'm the only person of color in my entire town. And so that made it incredibly uncomfortable for me growing up, you know, dealing with racism, dealing with, you know, a number of things, where home didn't always encapsulate these really positive moments. Like, I feel like where I would go to other households like Sam's, and I'd see, and I'd look like Andrew Largeman, where I'd be like, what is happening? You guys could share these moments. And that's so bizarre to me. And so I actually went to boarding school around the same time that Andrew Largeman did. And I had spent time away, and I had, you know, I had grown so much since then. I went to high school in Virginia. I went to college in New Jersey. But while I was in Virginia in high school, because I left home at like 13, instead of having Andrew Largeman's existential crisis about what is home at like mid-20s, I had that in my mid-teens. And this is the beautiful thing about this story, is that my high school English teacher, I had a very cool, typical, stereotypical, cool high school English teacher that was a fresh grad from college, and it was like her first job. And I was telling her this because I didn't really know who to turn to. You know, you don't have your mom there at boarding school. Exactly how Andrew Largeman did. You don't have your parents there, so you kind of turn to whoever. And I was saying, I'm very scared of the future because I'm not the same person as when I left Maine, right? Like, I had grown so much, and then I experienced so many cultures. And when I went back home, it kind of felt like talking to Mark, right? Where you're like, some things haven't changed, and it's weird because I'm different, and it's not the same. It's kind of exactly, you know, the hallway bathroom situation. My parents turned my bedroom into a guest bedroom, and, you know, you're like, this is so weird, and I don't know how to deal with this. And like, what does that mean for home if my home is different? And I'm like 15, and my high school English teacher was like, I totally relate to this. I watched this movie in college. She lived in the dorms. Like, she was like a dorm mom.
Okay.
Hi, Sanford, if you're listening to this, which I know you are, hello. So this beautiful teacher, Annabeth Sanford, she was like, come through to my room and we'll watch this movie. I think you need to watch it. Because I reminded her, I guess, a lot of her in high school. Like, she showed me The Garden State, and then she burned me the soundtrack, which I still have in my bedroom to this day. And it was pretty much just me realizing that this is commonplace for everyone. Like, I thought this was just a singular experience that, because I, you know, it was kind of like a woe is me thing when I was 15, being like, dang, like, I really was kicked out of my own, not kicked out of my home, but, you know, you didn't feel comfortable there. And then you're forced to go to another place. And then, you know, because of that, you've changed a lot. And I have been out of the house now for about, similar to Andrew Largeman's time, 8 years now, 9 years now. Mm-hmm. And you changed so much, and it's so interesting. But I felt so alone in that process. I felt, because it was, I went to boarding school, because I did this, because I did that, and it was only me going through it. But the movie really showed me that everyone goes through it. This is just, again, the bird has to leave the nest. And it's just because of my specific experience that it had come earlier. But that doesn't mean that everyone won't relate to it at some point. And as I've grown older, it's been so interesting because people have come to me being like, my home is different and it's weird. And I go, oh, yeah, I know. And there's this one quote that really hits deep with me in the movie, is when Andrew Largeman, and this is exactly how I felt at 15, you know, where he says, you know, there's that point in your life when you realize that the house you grew up in isn't really your home anymore. All of a sudden, even though you still have some place where you put your shit, that idea of home is gone. You'll see one day when you move out, it just sort of happens one day and it's gone. You feel like you can never get it back. It's like you feel homesick for a place that doesn't even exist. Maybe it's like this rite of passage, you know? Maybe you won't have this feeling again until you create a new idea of home for yourself, you know, for your kids, for the family you start. Like, it's a cycle or something. I don't know, but I miss the idea of it, you know? Maybe that's all a family really is, a group of people that miss the same imaginary place. So I think that quote for me really, wow, you know, I didn't have that idea of home, but the hope, you have that turning point for him. Maybe that's what family is. Maybe that's all these relationships are that you have with your friends, with Mark, with Sam. That's this new concept of your chosen family and your chosen home and what you make for yourself. And it becomes a lot more active. You have a lot more choice in that, right?
Yeah.
And I thought that was so uplifting to me specifically. And I think for a lot of people that come from, the movies don't often show these difficult transitional periods or, hey, I come from, my house isn't always great. I don't always have like the most supportive parents or whatever, you know? And I think the idea of the chosen family is so important. Mm-hmm. And the hope in that oddly kind of hopeless feeling situation.
Is there anything you want to say to wrap up? You are an artist and an editor, so how can we support you? How can our listeners like follow you and what journey? Promote yourself.
Yes, I am big into collaborations with artists. I consider myself, you know, I'm a video editor by trade, but I do consider myself an artist, a musician, a photographer. So I am huge into collaboration. So artists, musicians, photographers, designers, storytellers, feel free to follow me at Joy Affleck, spelled JOIEAFFLECK, Affleck like Ben Affleck, on Instagram so we can make something. Currently, I have no projects underway, but big goals for 2022, so please stay tuned. I might make a separate Instagram for, you know, my media, all of this stuff, but that will be later. So just follow me on Joy Affleck.
Awesome. Well, this has been lovely, Joy.
I love you so much, Talia. This has been the best.
Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast, was produced by Talia Smith and Emily Joba. You can buy us a coffee to support this podcast at buymeacoffee.com/onceuponatimepc. Our guest today was Joy Affleck, and our story was the film The Garden State. Our featured artist this week was Michaela Simon, and you can check out her work on Instagram and in our show notes. Music is Heart of Acceptance by John Bartman. Our Instagram is A Storytelling Podcast, and our email is astorytellingpodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, too. You can listen in on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening now. Links to all of our resources are in the show notes and on our websites. The end.